From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Baltimore is pockmarked by thousands of abandoned homes and empty lots. What effect do vacant properties have on health? What can the city do to transform blight into inviting outdoor spaces? Former State Secretary of Health Joshua Sharfstein points to research that measures how blight raises stress levels.
Their heart rates went up when they passed an abandoned block and they were nervous. They were worried that maybe somebody or something was lurking there. And then you go to a different place and people want to enter. They feel calm. They feel happier. They want to have a meeting there.
And Stephanie Smith of the City Planning Department describes a plan to turn vacant properties into parks, playgrounds, and trails. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Baltimore is pockmarked by thousands of abandoned lots and empty row houses. For years, the city has tried to chip away at the problem with efforts like the Dollar Homes Program and Vacants to Value. But a new plan aims to transform vacant properties into green space, pocket parks, trails, and playgrounds. Later, we'll talk about the Baltimore Green Network and how the network is bringing together communities, city agencies, and nonprofits. Let's start by understanding how vacant homes and lots impact public health. What health issues are connected to living near blocks of empty homes? Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is here with us. He's Vice Dean for Public Health Practices and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. Before his years as Maryland's Health Secretary from 2011 to 2014, Sharfstein served as the Principal Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and before that, as Baltimore City's Health Commissioner. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications for the City's Department of Planning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
On April 23rd, Dr. Sharfstein and Stephanie Smith will be part of a panel discussion titled Health and Vacancy, the Case for Baltimore at Morgan State University. The event is presented by Morgan School of Architecture and Planning and the American Institute of Architects Baltimore chapter. We'll link to the event details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Stephanie Smith, give us a sense of the scope of the problem. How many vacant properties are there across the city?
Roughly 30,000. Vacant and abandoned properties.
So that's both empty properties and homes or
yes.
buildings.
Yeah, and summer structures, yes.
What neighborhoods have the highest concentrations of vacant properties?
Those are the focus areas for the Green Network plan. We concentrated on the communities that had the highest rates of abandoned and vacant lots. We're talking about the Broadway East community in East Baltimore and kind of that surrounding concentration. We're also looking in the Southwest area, Carrollton Ridge, that area. In the central area, we're looking at Druid Heights, Upton, that kind of concentration. Those are the biggest pockets in East and West Baltimore.
Dr. Sharfstein, what public health problems are linked to vacant and abandoned properties?
Quite a lot of them. Vacant and abandoned properties have direct and indirect effects on health. So the direct effects include crime, drug use, Other problems that happen in vacant buildings or in abandoned lots that then have the indirect effects of people being fearful, people not wanting to get together with their neighbors to solve neighborhood problems. It reduces the activities that communities do together. It actually increases stress that can cause chronic disease and make people depressed.
Walk me through the stress impact.
Well, you know, there was a really interesting study where they literally walked around with people in Philadelphia, I believe, and they walked them past abandoned lots and checked their stress responses, including blood pressure and heart rate, for example. And then they walked them past other areas that had been greened, that were now gardens or places that people could go and sit and read a book and look just completely different. And they saw completely opposite responses, that people felt stressed, their heart rates went up when they passed an abandoned block and they were nervous. They were worried that maybe some buddy or something was lurking there, and then you go to a different place and people want to enter, they feel calm, they feel happier, they want to have a meeting there, people spend a lot more time there and outside, and that just makes their whole neighborhood safer and, you know, start to move in the right direction.
One out of five children in the city of Baltimore suffers from asthma. That prevalence is double the national average. Why so much asthma here, and how is that connected to vacant properties?
It is connected to vacant properties, too. There are a number of reasons why there's so much asthma. One big reason is just the ambient air pollution that exists in urban areas. You see, most urban areas have a pretty significant asthma problem. But you also have a problem, particularly in Baltimore, with pests, particularly mice and mouse urine antigens are trigger a kid's asthma, very well studied in the city. And so when you have abandoned properties that can be overrun by pests, for example, that can just create problems. It makes it harder to control the rodent problems in adjoining properties, and it can just make for a lot more allergens that can make kids a lot sicker.
Are these kinds of health problems unique to city life?
Well, the vacancy problem kind of is more unique to city life. It's because we all live so close together and our neighborhoods are so much more compact that, you know, literally one house can destabilize another house, either physically or kind of psychologically. And so in urban areas, it's really important for the community to be intact. And when you have vacancies and blighted areas, it really makes it hard for people to do the things that are necessary to turn areas around. It's hard to recruit new businesses. It's hard to, generate neighbor-led efforts. I mean, I'll just give you one statistic that, as I was looking at the evidence, really I thought was amazing. When they cleaned and greened vacant lots in a city, they found reductions in crime and vandalism. You know, they were measurable reductions, like 5-10% reductions. But they saw a 58% decline in the fear of going outside and a 76% increase in the use of open spaces. So people's perceptions and how they act changed a huge amount. So it's not just, yes, it actually makes things better, but people just feel better. I mean, anyone can imagine what it's like to live near a beautiful garden and compare that to an abandoned lot where people are dumping trash. And it's not just the direct effects. It's just the way it makes you feel. And that has all kinds of indirect effects for health.
But let me make sure I understand. Either one of you can jump in on this. When you talk about greening a vacant, I mean, you're not talking necessarily about redeveloping it, building a new home there, getting a thriving business there. You're talking about relatively little investment in growing plants.
Yeah, I'll just say in one of these studies, they said it was about $5 per square meter of investment with about 50 cents or so per year of ongoing maintenance. So relatively cheap, but big difference for people's perception of their neighborhood. And of course, you do need often to build new things, but you can't necessarily build something new on every single vacant lot. And turning some of them into communal areas and green spaces really makes everybody's life a little bit better.
I want to say that the Green Network Plan sees greening as sometimes also a strategy to attract future infill development, because you can leverage some of the greening opportunities. You know, it could be on, let's say, a plot of land that hasn't been doing much of anything that's now become a central square where community activity is happening and a hub of socializing. That creates an opportunity perhaps for all types of vending. That could be a place where food trucks start to assemble, a place where people start to engage in certain types of recreation. So we definitely see some aspects of the Green Network Plan being more permanent, like the Charm City bike loop. It doesn't have a name, but that's kind of like a working name. That's something that would have a permanent benefit connecting people to commercial nodes and corridors. But there could be some transformation of vacant lots that are having an intermediate purpose, perhaps for 5 to 10 years to stabilize this property in a community, but it could also leverage future investments.
That's Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications for the City's Department of Planning. Here on The Record on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about how vacant and abandoned properties damage public health. The neighborhoods in the city with the most vacant properties are areas that have seen disinvestment by the city for decades. How do you build trust in communities like that? I presume that it takes some level of trust by the community for these effects to be seen.
I think it was really important for our community planners, because we do have a division within the agency where people are geographically dispatched to continue to have ongoing relationships with community leaders and associations. So in the focus areas, it was really important that any type of proposed greening be something that the community not only had buy-in, but perhaps were part of identifying the parcels of land that they thought made the most sense and had the most value to them. When you're greening, it's really important to make sure that a community member sees the value of the parcel. Sometimes, for example, you and I might like trees, but someone else might have concerns about what trees could mean in terms of, could people be using a tree to hide something? Things that sometimes might not come to mind. So for these greening efforts to be sustainable and to ultimately be beneficial to the community, we did a series of charrettes and meetings with the community over a period of years to really determine what they wanted, come back with the renderings, get further feedback, so that before we embark on actually implementing some of these plans, it would have been well vetted. And as you probably know, the state has a Project CORE program that targets demolition and deconstruction of properties.
Yeah, Governor Hogan announced its $75 million program. It's just in Baltimore,
just
although
in
it's a state program. Announced it in 2016. Is the city's Department of Planning involved in Project CORE?
Yes, we do work with our colleagues at HCD, Housing and Community Development, to determine what are some areas within many of the focus areas, because they are the sites of the most vacant and abandoned properties, to figure out what type of targeted demolition makes sense. Because sometimes you have an abandoned property that its dimensions are not suitable for transformation on their own. But if there's already a decaying adjacent property, it might make sense to create a small park there. Or also to look at where community members say, pause, we don't want that parcel of land to be demolished. We actually think that could be repurposed or reconstructed to something else. It's really important to listen to communities, which is a big part of why I'm at planning, thinking about equity engagement, because I think for too long we've assumed what community members wanted, and then there's the blowback. If we're very thoughtful about making sure these greening projects are reflective of their priorities, I think it's a win-win.
And if you accept the premise, which I certainly do, that one of the main purposes is to energize a community and to support the community's energy, the community's perception being so important, then doing a plan that the community has come up with is really where you want to land, because that's really half the battle. It's not just to green the space. It's to green the space in a way that people then continue to advance. They do the next thing. They decide to have their community meetings there. All the things that they came up with as part of the plan, they then do. It's the opposite side of the coin to when it's vacant, when it's abandoned, people don't want to do anything and they feel powerless. You're doing it in such a way that they feel the energy and empowerment, working with people who can come in and fix things up the way they want them to be fixed up.
Quick break here on the record. I'm speaking with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Stephanie Smith of the city's Department of Planning. When we come back, a look at some of the green space projects planned for the city. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Last month, Mayor Pugh formally announced the Baltimore Green Network, an effort by the Planning Department and the Office of Sustainability to transform vacant properties into green spaces. What is the power of parks, playgrounds, and trails? What impact does transforming abandoned property into green space have on a community's well-being? Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning, is here. So is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean for Public Health practice and community engagement at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. Both will be part of a panel discussion at Morgan State University later this month, talking about public health and vacant properties. Stephanie Smith, the Baltimore Green Network has been in the works for about 2 years. Tell us about it.
I think that there are a lot of projects across the city that think about greening in a smaller way. There might be opportunity to adopt a lot. But this is the first time that we're knitting together the theory that if we have an actual connected citywide network of green space, that this could be leveraged to, you know, attract investment and also to improve the life and the health outcomes for community members, particularly in the parts of the city that have the most acute amount of vacant and abandoned lots. Many people are familiar with kind of the terms building from strength, and anyone that's been to planning school or is familiar with kind of the housing market typology that many cities utilize. When you're building from market strength, which is really the strength that they're mentioning, you oftentimes do not get to the most distressed community because you're continuously centering communities that are more on the brink, right? So I think what's really important about this is that we're almost redefining what strength is. It's not simply where the markets are currently, but where the enduring population is, where there could be not just greening that can be leveraged, but even history. You know, Baltimore's an old city, and there's opportunities to, through the greening, to have new markers of history. Things have happened in these communities that sometimes get lost because we think of it as landscapes full of blight. But there are people there. There are people that are committed and people that, quite frankly, could have moved.
And help me understand the word network. I mean, are you talking about these projects being contiguous to each other so that one can step from one to another?
Not exactly. We already have tremendous green amenities. We have major parks like Patterson, Druid Hill. We also have beautiful tree canopy. We go around the Gwynn Falls area. You know, that we have pockets of just natural heritage that is beautiful, but sometimes there's difficulty connecting that experience. That's why the potential to have a 35-mile bike and walk trail could connect these things, but it also is an opportunity to think about how could there be a connection with even public transit to some of these amenities, because quite frankly, we are realizing, particularly in communities that are suffering from a lot of economic challenges, roughly 70% of low-income households in the city do not have access to a car, right? So the way that we can enhance the connectivity of the existing green network with people that are dependent on foot, on transit, and also how we can bring green amenities to the places they already live. That's what the network means.
So tell me about some of the projects.
Well, one of the projects that we highlighted at our press event with the mayor was actually taking a vacant lot and transforming it into a park that was also going to be a memorial to Rachel Wilson, who was a firefighter that I believe was one of the first women to unfortunately die in the line of duty during a training. And this was roughly about 10 years ago, almost to the month or two. And the African-American firefighters had been for years trying to figure out how they could use our greening project to commemorate their fallen comrades. And they really weren't getting any traction until they were able to plug into kind of the advisory team of nonprofits and community groups that were contemplating the Green Network plan from its inception. So that would be located in the Southwest focus area in the Carrollton Ridge, Boyd Booth, Shipley Hill area. There is some issues where we're going to have to acquire some parcels of land so that you do have, you know, a contained park. But I think what's really important about that is that it's also lifting up a community member as well as providing a green amenity. So there's this recognition that people in this community do matter. So that's something we're particularly excited about because the firefighters did not have experience in land use and navigating that entire kind of process. So this is going to give an on-ramp for community members to plug in because at the conclusion of the public comment period and when we update this series of plans, the goal is to have a resident handbook so that residents and community members can also figure out how they can harness the existing vacant spaces in their community.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning, and with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and former Health Commissioner of Baltimore and Health Secretary of the State. We're talking about the public health concerns caused by blighted and abandoned properties and the city's plan to turn some of these properties into green space. Dr. Sharfstein, the negative health impacts that you talked about earlier, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, asthma, how reversible are these conditions if the environment improves?
Well, I think we have to realize that it's often not just one thing that makes life better for people. Often it takes a few things to make life better for people, but these conditions are reversible. People who are under a lot of stress, you can reduce the stress that they're on. People who, because of the way their neighborhood looks and feels, are depressed when they or fearful when they walk outside, as the study in Philadelphia showed, can become quite less depressed and fearful. And there are even asthma. If you remove the allergen, you may not get rid of the asthma, but you certainly can get rid of the trips to the emergency room and the hospital admissions. So I think that what we're hearing and what Stephanie's been talking about is a very promising initiative. It is a planning initiative, it's a greening initiative, but it's also a health initiative. And I think it's important to realize this doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are other efforts in the city, other efforts the health department's leading that will hopefully have a combined effect in different parts of the city and help people with the incredible burden that people in the city face right now.
Well, Stephanie Smith, I think some people may be listening to this conversation and thinking, where is the money going to come from and how much money would it take to do the approach you're talking about?
That was actually something even at the community planning level that people would raise, you know, particularly around maintenance. No one wants a new site for dumping or some of these other concerns, right? They want to know that an area can stay clean and that any type of vegetation planted will be maintained. So that I would want to lift up as was a primary message we were hearing from community members. So that's why it was really important for us to build in commitments with our other agency partners, because they are the implementing agencies, the Department of Public Works, Department of Transit. So that leadership is definitely on board in making this possible. There's no way Department of Planning could do that alone. Now, when it comes to the dollars and cents, there are some opportunities to apply for federal grants, particularly around the rail to trail 35-mile loop that I mentioned. There's also some other opportunities to apply for state funding. So I'll admit, you know, that's something where we're having some challenges, but we're actually optimistic that even the foundation community in Baltimore would be receptive.
Dr. Sharfstein, Maryland has gone further than some states in creating responsibility on hospitals in particular, on health providers in general, for the overall health status of the people they serve, so that Maryland hospitals actually get paid for keeping people out of the hospital. Is there some way in which some of the money in the health system can be harnessed to make these improvements that you say would help our health?
I think that's a terrific idea. Every hospital in the city has a community benefit plan, which fits in with their overall strategic plan. And one of the things that they're really trying to do in Maryland is find ways to prevent admissions and prevent people from getting sick enough to need to come into the hospital. There was just a really interesting report that came out finding that at least for people in the Medicare program, older adults, Maryland had more than a 9% decline in preventable admissions compared to comparison population that was associated with this different way of paying hospitals. And you can see, there's a good story recently in the Baltimore Sun, you can see some of the things the hospitals are doing to accomplish that. It's a lot of taking better care of people with chronic illness. It's making sure that they're getting their medicines, not just their prescriptions, making sure they have appointments, not just phone numbers to call. Like, the first set of things that a lot of hospitals are doing are really kind of the bread and butter of making sure that people with chronic illness get better health care. But I think there's another level that hospitals can get to. I think a number of them are very interested, and I think partnering with local communities around these kinds of projects is like win-win-win for them. I would say that, you know, as people get excited about the plan that the planning department is putting together, I think it's really important to get the major private sector partners to the table, and that certainly includes hospitals in the city of Baltimore.
Stephanie Smith, how many vacant properties would these projects repurpose?
I don't know the exact number, but I know that each of these projects involve at least three blocks, if that makes sense.
Three city blocks.
Right. Pretty big. Some of them were vacant lots in the sense that there weren't properties on them. You know, they just weren't doing much of anything. But these are just the focus area projects. This is not the summation of what the Green Network Plan can accomplish.
So what are the next steps for the network?
We're having a public comment period right now. It began on March 5th. It concludes through April 30th, the end of this month. And what's really important about this public comment period, because I know that's not the sexiest topic for folks, is that we're doing something new. We're using a platform called Civic Comment. So when people are giving input on the plan, they can actually give input directly on the page that's motivating their thoughts. And they can also see the comments of everyone else in real time. We want to add transparency to every aspect of our assessment of what communities want in ways that we maybe have not done in the past. And we hope this can become our standard moving forward.
Thanks to you both for telling us about it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Stephanie Smith is Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning. She is also a candidate for state delegate in the Democratic primary in the 45th District of Northeast Baltimore. Both will be speaking at the event Health and Vacancy, The Case for Baltimore, on April 23rd, a week from Monday, at Morgan State University. We'll link to event details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Gast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.
From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Baltimore is pockmarked by thousands of abandoned homes and empty lots. What effect do vacant properties have on health? What can the city do to transform blight into inviting outdoor spaces? Former State Secretary of Health Joshua Sharfstein points to research that measures how blight raises stress levels.
Their heart rates went up when they passed an abandoned block and they were nervous. They were worried that maybe somebody or something was lurking there. And then you go to a different place and people want to enter. They feel calm. They feel happier. They want to have a meeting there.
And Stephanie Smith of the City Planning Department describes a plan to turn vacant properties into parks, playgrounds, and trails. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Baltimore is pockmarked by thousands of abandoned lots and empty row houses. For years, the city has tried to chip away at the problem with efforts like the Dollar Homes Program and Vacants to Value. But a new plan aims to transform vacant properties into green space, pocket parks, trails, and playgrounds. Later, we'll talk about the Baltimore Green Network and how the network is bringing together communities, city agencies, and nonprofits. Let's start by understanding how vacant homes and lots impact public health. What health issues are connected to living near blocks of empty homes? Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is here with us. He's Vice Dean for Public Health Practices and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. Before his years as Maryland's Health Secretary from 2011 to 2014, Sharfstein served as the Principal Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and before that, as Baltimore City's Health Commissioner. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications for the City's Department of Planning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
On April 23rd, Dr. Sharfstein and Stephanie Smith will be part of a panel discussion titled Health and Vacancy, The Case for Baltimore at Morgan State University. The event is presented by Morgan School of Architecture and Planning and the American Institute of Architects Baltimore chapter. We'll link to the event details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Stephanie Smith, give us a sense of the scope of the problem. How many vacant properties are there across the city?
Roughly 30,000. Vacant and abandoned properties.
So that's both empty properties And homes or yes. buildings.
Yeah, and summer structures, yes.
What neighborhoods have the highest concentrations of vacant properties?
Those are the focus areas for the Green Network plan. We concentrated on the communities that had the highest rates of abandoned and vacant lots. We're talking about the Broadway East community in East Baltimore and kind of that surrounding concentration. We're also looking in the Southwest area, Carrollton Ridge, that area. In the Central area, we're looking at Druid Heights, Upton. That kind of concentration. Those are the biggest pockets in East and West Baltimore.
Dr. Sharfstein, what public health problems are linked to vacant and abandoned properties?
Quite a lot of them. Vacant and abandoned properties have direct and indirect effects on health. So the direct effects include crime, drug use, other problems that happen in vacant buildings or in abandoned lots that then have the indirect effects of people being fearful, people not wanting to get together with their neighbors to solve neighborhood problems. It reduces the activities that communities do together. It actually increases stress that can cause chronic disease and make people depressed.
Walk me through the stress impact.
Well, you know, there was a really interesting study where they literally walked around with people in Philadelphia, I believe, and they walked them past abandoned lots and checked their stress responses, including blood pressure and heart rate, for example. And then they walked them past other areas that had been greened, that were now gardens or places that people could go and sit and read a book and look just completely different. And they saw completely opposite responses, that people felt stressed, their heart rates went up when they passed an abandoned block and they were nervous. They were worried that maybe somebody or something was lurking there. And then you go to a different place and people want to enter. They feel calm. They feel happier. They want to have a meeting there. People spend a lot more time there and outside. And that just makes their whole neighborhood safer and, you know, start to move in the right direction.
One out of five children in the city of Baltimore suffers from asthma. That prevalence is double the national average. Why so much asthma here, and how is that connected to vacant properties?
It is connected to vacant properties, too. There are a number of reasons why there's so much asthma. One big reason is just the ambient air pollution that exists in urban areas. You see, most urban areas have a pretty significant asthma problem. But you also have a problem, particularly in Baltimore, with pests, particularly mice and mouse urine antigens are trigger a kid's asthma, very well studied in the city. And so when you have abandoned properties that can be overrun by pests, for example, that can just create problems. It makes it harder to control the rodent problems in adjoining properties, and it can just make for a lot more allergens that can make kids a lot sicker.
Are these kinds of health problems unique to city life?
Well, the vacancy problem kind of is more unique to city life. It's because we all live so close together and our neighborhoods are so much more compact that, you know, literally one house can destabilize another house, either physically or kind of psychologically. And so in urban areas, it's really important for the community to be intact. And when you have vacancies and blighted areas, it really makes it hard for people to do the things that are necessary to turn areas around. It's hard to recruit new businesses. It's hard to, generate neighbor-led efforts. I mean, I'll just give you one statistic that, as I was looking at the evidence, really I thought was amazing. When they cleaned and greened vacant lots in a city, they found reductions in crime and vandalism. You know, they were measurable reductions, like 5-10% reductions. But they saw a 58% decline in the fear of going outside and a 76% increase in the use of open spaces. So people's perceptions and how they act changed a huge amount. So it's not just, yes, it actually makes things better, but people just feel better. I mean, anyone can imagine what it's like to live near a beautiful garden and compare that to an abandoned lot where people are dumping trash. And it's not just the direct effects. It's just the way it makes you feel. And that has all kinds of indirect effects for health.
But let me make sure I understand. Either one of you can jump in on this. When you talk about greening a vacant, I mean, you're not talking necessarily about redeveloping it, building a new home there, getting a thriving business there. You're talking about relatively little investment in growing plants.
Yeah, I'll just say in one of these studies, they said it was about $5 per square meter of investment with about 50 cents or so per year of ongoing maintenance. So relatively cheap, but big difference for people's perception of their neighborhood. And of course, you do need often to build new things, but you can't necessarily build something new on every single vacant lot. And turning some of them into communal areas and green spaces really makes everybody's life a little bit better.
I want to say that the Green Network Plan sees greening as sometimes also a strategy to attract future infill development, because you can leverage some of the greening opportunities. You know, it could be on, let's say, a plot of land that hasn't been doing much of anything that's now become a central square where community activity is happening and a hub of socializing. That creates an opportunity perhaps for all types of vending. That could be a place where food trucks start to assemble, a place where people start to engage in certain types of recreation. So we definitely see some aspects of the Green Network Plan being more permanent, like the Charm City bike loop. It doesn't have a name, but that's kind of like a working name. That's something that would have a permanent benefit connecting people to commercial nodes and corridors. But there could be some transformation of vacant lots that are having an intermediate purpose, perhaps for 5 to 10 years to stabilize this property in a community, but it could also leverage future investments.
That's Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications for the City's Department of Planning. Here on The Record on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about how vacant and abandoned properties damage public health. The neighborhoods in the city with the most vacant properties are areas that have seen disinvestment by the city for decades. How do you build trust in communities like that? I presume that it takes some level of trust by the community for these effects to be seen.
I think it was really important for our community planners, because we do have a division within the agency where people are geographically dispatched to continue to have ongoing relationships with community leaders and associations. So in the focus areas, it was really important that any type of proposed greening be something that the community not only had buy-in, but perhaps were part of identifying the parcels of land that they thought made the most sense and had the most value to them. When you're greening, it's really important to make sure that a community member sees the value of the parcel. Sometimes, for example, you and I might like trees, but someone else might have concerns about what trees could mean in terms of, could people be using a tree to hide something? Things that sometimes might not come to mind. So for these greening efforts to be sustainable and to ultimately be beneficial to the community, we did a series of charrettes and meetings with the community over a period of years to really determine what they wanted, come back with the renderings, get further feedback, so that before we embark on actually implementing some of these plans, it would have been well vetted. And as you probably know, the state has a Project CORE program that targets demolition and deconstruction of properties.
Yeah, Governor Hogan announced its $75 million program. It's just in Baltimore,
just
although
in Baltimore.
It's a state program. Announced it in 2016. Is the city's Department of Planning involved in Project CORE?
Yes, we do work with our colleagues at HCD, Housing and Community Development, to determine what are some areas within many of the focus areas, because they are the sites of the most vacant and abandoned properties, to figure out what type of targeted demolition makes sense. Because sometimes you have an abandoned property that its dimensions are not suitable for transformation on their own. But if there's already a decaying adjacent property, it might make sense to create a small park there. Or also to look at where community members say, pause, we don't want that parcel of land to be demolished. We actually think that could be repurposed or reconstructed to something else. It's really important to listen to communities, which is a big part of why I'm at planning, thinking about equity engagement, because I think for too long we've assumed what community members wanted, and then there's the blowback. If we're very thoughtful about making sure these greening projects are reflective of their priorities, I think it's a win-win.
And if you accept the premise, which I certainly do, that one of the main purposes is to energize a community and to support the community's energy, the community's perception being so important, then doing a plan that the community has come up with is really where you want to land, because that's really half the battle. It's not just to green the space. It's to green the space in a way that people then continue to advance. They do the next thing. They decide to have their community meetings there. All the things that they came up with as part of the plan, they then do. It's the opposite side of the coin to when it's vacant, when it's abandoned. people don't want to do anything and they feel powerless, you're doing it in such a way that they feel the energy and empowerment, working with people who can come in and fix things up the way they want them to be fixed up.
Quick break here on the record. I'm speaking with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Stephanie Smith of the city's Department of Planning. When we come back, a look at some of the green space projects planned for the city. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Last month, Mayor Pugh formally announced the Baltimore Green Network, an effort by the Planning Department and the Office of Sustainability to transform vacant properties into green spaces. What is the power of parks, playgrounds, and trails? What impact does transforming abandoned property into green space have on a community's well-being? Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning, is here. So is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. Both will be part of a panel discussion at Morgan State University later this month, talking about public health and vacant properties. Stephanie Smith, the Baltimore Green Network has been in the works for about 2 years. Tell us about it.
I think that there are a lot of projects across the city that think about greening in a smaller way. There might be opportunity to adopt a lot. But this is the first time that we're knitting together the theory that if we have an actual connected citywide network of green space, that this could be leveraged to, you know, attract investment and also to improve the life and the health outcomes for community members, particularly in the parts of the city that have the most acute amount of vacant and abandoned lots. Many people are familiar with kind of the terms building from strength, and anyone that's been to planning school or is familiar with kind of the housing market typology that many cities utilize. When you're building from market strength, which is really the strength that they're mentioning, you oftentimes do not get to the most distressed community because you're continuously centering communities that are more on the brink, right? So I think what's really important about this is that we're almost redefining what strength is. It's not simply where the markets are currently, but where the enduring population is, where there could be not just greening that can be leveraged, but even history. You know, Baltimore's an old city, and there's opportunities to, through the greening, to have new markers of history. Things have happened in these communities that sometimes get lost because we think of it as landscapes full of blight. But there are people there. There are people that are committed and people that, quite frankly, could have moved.
And help me understand the word network. I mean, are you talking about these projects being contiguous to each other so that one can step from one to another?
Not exactly. We already have tremendous green amenities. We have major parks like Patterson, Druid Hill. We also have beautiful tree canopy. We go around the Gwynn Falls area. You know, that we have pockets of just natural heritage that is beautiful, but sometimes there's difficulty connecting that experience. That's why the potential to have a 35-mile bike and walk trail could connect these things, but it also is an opportunity to think about how could there be a connection with even public transit to some of these amenities, because quite frankly, we are realizing, particularly in communities that are suffering from a lot of economic challenges, roughly 70% of low-income households in the city do not have access to a car, right? So the way that we can enhance the connectivity of the existing green network with people that are dependent on foot, on transit, and also how we can bring green amenities to the places they already live. That's what the network means.
So tell me about some of the projects.
Well, one of the projects that we highlighted at our press event with the mayor was actually taking a vacant lot and transforming it into a park that was also going to be a memorial to Rachel Wilson, who was a firefighter that I believe was one of the first women to unfortunately die in the line of duty during a training. And this was roughly about 10 years ago, almost to the month or two. And the African-American firefighters had been for years trying to figure out how they could use our greening project to commemorate their fallen comrade. And they really weren't getting any traction until they were able to plug into kind of the advisory team of nonprofits and community groups that were contemplating the Green Network plan from its inception. So that would be located in the Southwest focus area in the Carrollton Ridge, Boyd Booth, Shipley Hill area. There is some issues where we're going to have to acquire some parcels of land so that you do have, you know, a contained park. But I think what's really important about that is that it's also lifting up a community member as well as providing a green amenity. So there's this recognition that people in this community do matter. So that's something we're particularly excited about because the firefighters did not have experience in land use and navigating that entire kind of process. So this is going to give an on-ramp for community members to plug in because at the conclusion of the public comment period and when we update this series of plans, the goal is to have a resident handbook so that residents and community members can also figure out how they can harness the existing vacant spaces in their community.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Stephanie Smith, Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning, and with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and former Health Commissioner of Baltimore and Health Secretary of the state. We're talking about the public health concerns caused by blighted and abandoned properties and the city's plan to turn some of these properties into green space. Dr. Sharfstein, the negative health impacts that you talked about earlier, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, asthma, how reversible are these conditions if the environment improves?
Well, I think we have to realize that it's often not just one thing that makes life better for people. Often it takes a few things to make life better for people, but these conditions are reversible. People who are under a lot of stress, you can reduce the stress that they're on. People who, because of the way their neighborhood looks and feels, are depressed when they or fearful when they walk outside, as the study in Philadelphia showed, can become quite less depressed and fearful. And there are even asthma. If you remove the allergen, you may not get rid of the asthma, but you certainly can get rid of the trips to the emergency room and the hospital admissions. So I think that what we're hearing and what Stephanie's been talking about is a very promising initiative. It is a planning initiative, it's a greening initiative, but it's also a health initiative. And I think it's important to realize this doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are other efforts in the city, other efforts the health department's leading that will hopefully have a combined effect in different parts of the city and help people with the incredible burden that people in the city face right now.
Well, Stephanie Smith, I think some people may be listening to this conversation and thinking, where is the money going to come from and how much money would it take to do the approach you're talking about?
That was actually something even at the community planning level that people would raise, you know, particularly around maintenance. No one wants a new site for dumping or some of these other concerns, right? They want to know that an area can stay clean and that any type of vegetation plant will be maintained. So that I would want to lift up as was a primary message we were hearing from community members. So that's why it was really important for us to build in commitments with our other agency partners because they are the implementing agencies, the Department of Public Works, Department of Transit. So that leadership is definitely on board in making this possible. There's no way Department of Planning could do that alone. Now, when it comes to the dollars and cents, there are some opportunities to apply for federal grants, particularly around the rail to trail 35-mile loop that I mentioned. There's also some other opportunities to apply for state funding. So I'll admit, you know, that's something where we're having some challenges, but we're actually optimistic that even the foundation community in Baltimore would be receptive.
Dr. Sharfstein, Maryland has gone further than some states in creating responsibility on hospitals in particular, on health providers in general, for the overall health status of the people they serve so that Maryland hospitals actually get paid for keeping people out of the hospital. Is there some way in which some of the money in the health system can be harnessed to make these improvements that you say would help our health?
I think that's a terrific idea. Every hospital in the city has a community benefit plan, which fits in with their overall strategic plan. And one of the things that they're really trying to do in Maryland is find ways to prevent admissions and prevent people from getting sick enough to need to come into the hospital. There was just a really interesting report that came out finding that at least for people in the Medicare program, older adults, Maryland had more than a 9% decline in preventable admissions compared to comparison population that was associated with this different way of paying hospitals. And you can see, there's a good story recently in the Baltimore Sun, you can see some of the things the hospitals are doing to accomplish that. It's a lot of taking better care of people with chronic illness. It's making sure that they're getting their medicines, not just their prescriptions, making sure they have appointments, not just phone numbers to call. Like the first set of things that a lot of hospitals are doing are really kind of the bread and butter of making sure that people with chronic illness get better health care. But I think there's another level that hospitals can get to. I think a number of them are very interested, and I think partnering with local communities around these kinds of projects is like win-win-win for them. I would say that, you know, as people get excited about the plan that the planning department is putting together, I think it's really important to get the major private sector partners to the table, and that certainly includes hospitals in the city of Baltimore.
Stephanie Smith, how many vacant properties would these projects repurpose?
I don't know the exact number, but I know that each of these projects involve at least three blocks, if that makes sense.
Three city blocks.
Right. Pretty big. Some of them were vacant lots in the sense that there weren't properties on them. You know, they just weren't doing much of anything. But these are just the focus area projects. This is not the summation of what the Green Network plan can accomplish.
So what are the next steps for the network?
We're having a public comment period right now. It began on March 5th. It concludes through April 30th, the end of this month. And what's really important about this public comment period, because I know that's not the sexiest topic for folks, is that we're doing something new. We're using a platform called Civic Comment. So when people are giving input on the plan, they can actually give input directly on the page that's motivating their thoughts. And they can also see the comments of everyone else in real time. We want to add transparency to every aspect of our assessment of what communities want in ways that we maybe have not done in the past. And we hope this can become our standard moving forward.
Thanks to you both for telling us about it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Stephanie Smith is Assistant Director for Equity, Engagement, and Communications in the city's Department of Planning. She is also a candidate for state delegate in the Democratic primary in the 45th District of Northeast Baltimore. Both will be speaking at the event Health and Vacancy, The Case for Baltimore, on April 23rd, a week from Monday, at Morgan State University. We'll link to event details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.